Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon, everyone. When you hear those Punch Brothers singing Movement and Location, you know it's time for the business of the business here on the Heritage Radio Network. The business of the business is the show where we explore the business side of the hospitality industry. We talk about restaurants and we talk about hotels and we talk about ancillary businesses that come out of the hospitality industry. We air every Wednesday at 5 o'clock, and if you miss us, and it's very rare that anyone ever misses this show, but if you do miss us, you can find us archived on www.heritageradionetwork.org or as a podcast on iTunes. So it's Wednesday, it's 5 o'clock, so let's get down to business. Structure is the theme of the day today. If you ever visit our studio, you'll note that we have a very interesting structure that we sit in a great part of Brooklyn, New York. But structure is critical. We don't think about it nearly enough. If a bridge isn't well built, well, it collapses. And if an aircraft is poorly designed, it won't fly. At least it won't fly for very long. And if a restaurant isn't structured properly, well, it becomes a laundromat pretty darn quick. So we know that there's one way to build that bridge, and we certainly know there's more than one method to design that aircraft. And really, it comes down to the old adage that there's more than one way to skin a cat. But if that cat is red, well, you better not skin it until you talk to my friend Jimmy Bradley here. Jimmy is our guest today. Jimmy has owned, operated, conceived, and cooked at the Red Cat restaurant since 1999. He also brought to life the very popular, beloved Harrison here in New York, two of New York City's truly great restaurants. Jimmy, thanks for making your way out to Brooklyn today.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you for having me.
You're very, very welcome. And, you know, you're a newlywed, kind of. How's that feeling?
Are we speaking about my personal life?
Well, you know, you've been doing the restaurant thing for a long time as a bachelor. You know, doing it as a married man, you feel more grounded, or are you feeling like it's more inspiring?
Probably the latter. You know, I like to share, and I like to do things with other people, and so I this is an extension of how I like to work. I like to go about work when I would do it. So I guess I enjoy it.
You know what? Marriage is hospitality, Jim. I agree with you.
That's always the serve relationship.
That's exactly right. Well, you know, the Red Cat's been open since 1999, and you don't run a restaurant in this town for 15 years without doing a really great job taking care of your neighborhood. And clearly the Red Cat's been known as one of the great institutional neighborhood restaurants. Was that the idea when you thought up the concept?
The idea was for lack of a better way to describe it, somewhat of a blank canvas. In other words, I knew what I wanted to do, but I didn't really know what neighborhood it should be in, and I didn't know the financial aspects of the deal. And so, to your point about a foundation,
yeah,
I wrote a business plan which had some specifics and then some variables in it, because I really truly believe that the foundation is the most important thing, the first most important thing to focus on. And a business plan is your first foray into public relations. And, you know, guess what? If you don't have a story, it's going to be difficult to tell it. So you might as well figure out what your story is and how you want to present it. And that's what I looked at as the business plan. And so we were. I had a business partner at that time in 1999, Danny right. Abrams,
yeah.
who has the Mermaid Inns
right.
now. He's
right.
very successful on his own. And we drove around the city and looked for spaces.
How old were you?
I was 31. I had made myself a goal, basically. It was a three-part goal that basically was own your own business by the time you're 30. Be financially able to have a family by the time you're 40, and pick a new career by the time you're 50, because you'll be doing it for 30 years then.
You know, I think that one's going down on the tombstone.
Yeah,
that's a good
I still got 5 years to figure it out. So, looking for the Red Cat, we had a lease out in the West Village, which is now an operating restaurant. I probably shouldn't say what it is, but. One day I was driving up 10th Avenue and I noticed the restaurant was named Zuka, and I noticed they were out of business. So I stopped the taxi and put my my business plan under the doorstep, and I got a phone call from the landlord, and we subsequently did the deal. But I didn't really set out to have a restaurant on 10th Avenue. I set out to have the Red Cat, and it was always going to be called the Red Cat, and I can tell you why. And it was always going to do what the Red Cat does. But I didn't know where it would be.
You know what? That's probably not the way they teach you at the CIA, right? That's not the, they don't say stick your business plan under the door of the first vacant building that you come across. But you know what? Why do things the traditional way, right? Yeah.
Creative times call for creative measures.
Bingo. So I'm curious, what do you remember about, now I probably read 1,000 restaurant business plans, and sometimes they read like the Magna Carta, and sometimes they're written on a you know, on the back of a business card. But almost all of them have, you know, one thing in common, and that's that there's a really, really strong idea behind it. Some people can articulate it well, and others just sort of feel it, you know. You know, we were talking about my cousin Tom before we started, and, you know, I remember when he was opening Kraft. It was very difficult for him to articulate the simplicity that really was behind his idea, and it really took the opening of the restaurant for the simplicity to make sense to people. How did you try to make sense of your concept in a business plan?
In the business plan, it was a little trickier because part of the business plan is you know, soliciting funds to open a restaurant. And clearly, when you ask people for money, they want a specific thought process, evaluations, and your honest opinion of what it should be and what it can be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I guess that being said, there's a couple different opportunities for us to phrase it one way or another. And the way that I thought about the Red Cat was, well, when I moved to New York in the early 90s, it was still somewhat understood that New York waiters could be mean or surly.
Right, right.
And that, you know, there was a certain experience that was offered in New York, and it was spoken about a certain way, and it wasn't the most hospitable. And then again, there were operators like Danny Meyer type operator.
Just starting out then, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess he was in 85 with Union Square the first time, mm-hmm. but, you know, his message I really identified with, and I thought, you know, what I really want to try to do is have a place that's not steeped in New York.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not about my fabulous address, and it's not about my celebrity investors, and it's not because I can hire the best architect that money can buy or, you know, the most popular person out there. It was really eschewing a lot of the groundwork that other people use to formulate their own businesses. And to say, well, if we don't do that, what would we be doing? And it was really just, you know, trying to provide for people on an honest, simple level that, you know, they clearly will understand.
Well, how'd you get people to buy into that? Because at that time, you're exactly right. That was the time of well, I don't want to sound like we're being petty, but I mean that's the time of the, you know, the big Rockwell buildings, you know, yeah. And the
BBD. And, I call it the bigger, better deal. Like you were saying about Tom and Kraft and the New Yorkers aren't necessarily the first ones to say, oh, that's simple, that's great, I want to do it that way.
That's correct.
They don't necessarily recognize some of the smaller nuances that go into the whole big picture.
And to your point about Danny Meyer, and we'll give him his cred, especially about the idea that his theory that you can teach nice people to serve, but you can't teach servers to be nice, you know? So I really thought that was a nice nugget to keep. And I think folks like you, I think that came very naturally to you. But how, when you were looking for investors, you were bringing a relatively new idea into the city, which was, hey, let's do something really good, really low key, and really nice. A place where we would like to hang out, right? If we could do it, how did you tell them it was going to be worth their while financially?
I guess I made the deal. Well, my business partner and I made the deal. We framed the deal in a certain way where it wasn't a high money investment. In other words, I'm going to generalize and make up numbers, but roughly. If you ask somebody for $10,000, it's different than if you ask somebody for $100,000.
Yes, it is. But you have to ask 10 people for $10,000, don't you?
Correct. But there's also something interesting that goes in with that I can explain it in further detail. But basically what I would say to people is, well, first, for $10,000 offerings, you would think you would go to your friends and family first. So if that was the case, I would say, hey, listen, I'd like you to invest $10,000, and for that, I'll give you X percentage of the restaurant. And if you want a lot of justifications, I don't really have them, but I can say this. If $10,000 is going to be the difference in your happiness, then I don't want you to invest. If it's really going to hurt, if we lose it, I don't want you to invest, but I want you to think of it this way. If I lose your 10 grand, I'll have lost everything I've ever owned. So that might make it a little more palatable for you.
Yeah, that's like the old parable, right? About the lady who has one penny puts it into the collection basket. She's given all she has.
Yeah, I went all in on my first hand. So.
That's cool. How many investors did you have?
Let's say the restaurant roughly took about $300,000 to bring online, so that would be roughly 30 investors.
Wow! All right, so that's quite an investors meeting.
Yeah, you know, there's two trains of thought, and the one train is, you know, the least amount of investors, the least amount of headaches. But the other side of it is, if you have, let's say, you have two people giving you $150,000 or three people giving you $100,000. I certainly think I have more responsibility to them, and they would require more from me in the relationship than 30 people at $10,000 each, especially if they were friends and family.
Well, you know what? You said the magic words. Two trains of thought. You know, there's more than two trains in this city, that's for sure. You know, we can't count the number of subways, but there are probably more financial vehicles in ways to raise money for a restaurant than there are subway trains in this town. Yours worked. Did you believe it was going to work right out of the gate? I mean, in some ways, Jim, when you say it the way you've said it, right? And I'm sitting here. You've been in business in a very solid way for 15 years. That sounded almost a little naive, right, with your first restaurant. Was it, now that you look back on it?
I mean, perhaps. Again, I was, you know, roughly 30 years old, and I thought I knew more then than I certainly think I know now, so perhaps. But really, again, I was pretty in tune with a message and a story and how to articulate the story and the necessity of publicity and things like that. So I thought, you know, the business plan, albeit a pain in the neck, was a great exercise for me to do, and I learned from it. Good. And, you know, trying to solicit money from 30 different people, you know, you have to meet with 60 if you're going to shake it down to 30. So it was very time consuming. But I thought, if I had 30 separate investors, all for not the biggest investment that they could make, and they each had different jobs. You know, somebody was an actor, somebody was a doctor, somebody was a lawyer, musicians. wouldn't I have a built-in crowd the day I open?
A constituency.
And
absolutely.
So, you know, hypothetically speaking, like, for instance, maybe the Harrison was done with different investors and a different deal, and the Harrison was more money because we bought an existing restaurant and paid some key money. We bought Spartina from Steve Colton.
You know what? We're definitely going to talk about the Harrison, because I do want to find out how you got on that other train. And we're talking to Jimmy Bradley, Jimmy of the Red Cat and of the Harrison here on the Business of the Business. Jim, do you still have those 30 investors?
We were able to sign a new lease after 10 years, and when we did that, we purchased the stock of most of all the other investors.
That's good. Yeah. So you built a community. You gave them a return on their investment, and then you bought them out.
I think they got about five times the money.
Well, you know what? I'm sure Jack Inslee's phone is ringing off the hook right now, because there aren't a lot of restaurateurs who can say that in this town. You know, it's hard to make a buck. I mean, this is not a business for the squeamish. This is not a business for people who think they want to make 30% and 40% on their investment, right? Really.
Correct.
Right, I mean, we all know, those of us who work in this environment with restaurants, especially in New York, where do you see profit margins when you started? What were you hoping to achieve as a profit margin?
I guess industry standards probably accepted in between 10% and 20%,
right,
where you are in America. So I thought, you know, what separates me from the industry standard? I was pretty much at peace. You know, I think industry standard is probably around 30% for a food cost.
Yeah.
I like to come in a few points below and,
right,
you know, make a little extra for the efforts. But, you know.
But you can't make it look – you got to make it look easy, right? You got to make it look easy to your investors and to your, you know, clients, your staff, right? But you know, when that door closes, you're the guy who sweats it out, right? You're the guy who's worrying about those food costs. You know, speaking of food, I note that we're about 15 minutes in, and it's Jack is giving me the wave that it's time for a break, and we're going to hear from Safeway Markets, our sponsor today. Here with Jimmy Bradley from the Red Cat, talking about how to open that restaurant and how to keep that cat red.
Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hey, we're back on the Business of the Business, and we're talking to my buddy Jimmy Bradley. When you hear Jimmy Bradley, you think, you know, right away, you think of a classic New York restaurateur, a terrific chef. You don't necessarily think Jimmy Bradley, the economics major, right? But you have to be a bit of an economics major if you're going to operate two restaurants in this town for as long as you have. You opened up the Harrison, which is a much different restaurant, much different concept than the Red Cat. How did you conceive of the Harrison? Where did that come from in your imagination?
Got it. The Harrison was a, you know, because it came after the Red Cat, it learned some of its lessons from the Red Cat. It was our second child, you know, so it didn't have to put up with some of the things the first one did, and it got to stand on its own in its own time frame. But really, I thought of the Tribeca market as similar to the Far West Chelsea market. In other words, they're not convenience-oriented neighborhoods, and most neighborhoods in New York are convenience-oriented. So the people that live there are really dedicated, committed people, you know, a couple blocks to get your groceries, no movie theaters, you know. So if you can get in that kind of community and provide for them and get them on your team, you can really have a great core business.
Did you learn that from the Red Cat? I mean, that's a pretty astute observation when you know a neighborhood has commitment to its really to its four block economy, right?
Sure. Some of it was what I saw and what I felt, and some of it was, oh yeah, tell me why. You know, so it was a 50-50 mix of gathering my data and my opinions, but then also saying, somebody tell me why you're doing it that way,
right?
And I'll tell you why I think I want to do it differently. The first exercise I did at the Harrison was move the front door from Greenwich Street, which is the address, to Harrison Street, which is the name.
Right.
And people freaked. They called me every name you can think of. And you're right. You know, it doesn't make sense to have the front door of your restaurant on a side street buried out back. But the other side of it is having it on the Greenwich Street had an internal vestibule in the restaurant that took up 15 seats.
There you go.
So the economics didn't
make any
sense.
There's the economics major coming out. There it is.
So I rolled the dice. And, you know, I figure if you got quality product and you care and you under promise and over deliver, does it really matter where your front door is? And if it does, tell me why.
Wow. Well, you know what? It doesn't sound like you do anything run of the mill. So that's, I mean, to me, that's, you know, that's great. Like, you're not left-handed, are you?
No.
Okay, all right.
But I do think that, you know, people want to be made to feel comfortable and they want to be served properly. And people that are in the hospitality business should be listening and not always offering what you want to offer, but, you know, a sincere adaptation. Like, you know, I'm more in it for the customer who's in it for the show than I'm in it for the customer who just wants to spend money.
Yeah.
Because the person who's there for the show is there because they're interested in what we do.
Well, I like, you know, frankly, I'm more old school when it comes to hospitality as well. I always thought that the shelf life of recent vintage where, you know, like heavy tasting menus, you don't have any choice diner, you know, we're not giving you vegetarian options. You're not, you know, you're here, and when you're here, you're you know, you're doing it my way or the highway. You know, I thought, okay, that'll be fun for a while, you know, but right. Getting tired of that, I think.
I like it to feel like more like you're coming over to my house. I know that you know you're not, and it's a public-private space, and it's a restaurant, but, you know, for all intents and purposes, I want to try to identify with you in a certain way.
So how did the economic structure of the Harrison differ from the economic structure of the Red Cat in terms of your fundraising? Yeah, you obviously didn't just reach into your pocket
and
do that. You probably went all in again.
Well, somewhat, but not so much. The Harrison was over $1 million to bring to life. And at that time, I had the investors from the Red Cat, and they had seen some small returns, which were good. But, you know, they also weren't the people that I would first approach to try to make a $1 million deal. So I put a larger net in the water, and I came out with four really great, completely supportive financial backers for the Harrison. So it was the exact opposite of the Red Cat. It was a bigger money deal with less people.
What did they expect of you? Did they? So you said $1 million, and so that means people are writing, you know, they're writing six-figure checks to you. Did they express expectations of you?
Yeah, absolutely. But some of the expectations were agreeing with some of our thoughts. In other words, I don't think that where the front door is located is going to matter. And if it does, we probably don't have the best idea. But it was also, I think you got your finger on what this neighborhood needs. and they were working in the neighborhood mm-hmm. at the time. And so, you know, we had an agreement between what they wanted, what I thought the neighborhood wanted, and what I really wanted to prepare and have, you know, somewhat of an amalgamation of those ideas.
I have to tell you that it's refreshing to hear that kind of dialogue exchanged. Again, I do enough work in this business to know that there are many investors who don't speak enough about what their expectations are. And then there are some investors who speak, you know, too much about things they don't know enough about.
Mm-hmm.
And these are risky investments. There's no question about it. You're exactly right. It's just like going to Atlantic City. Don't gamble more than you can afford to lose. You know, you shouldn't do that unless you're the guy behind, you know, behind the stove sweating it out, really. And then your success has limits because you're not in a business where you can just create more widgets. You
sure.
know?
And you're not always right, and you have to learn from your mistakes. Some of it is picking a place to start, and I prefer partnerships, and I prefer to build a group of people in agreement.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, if the mayor took a little bit more time and brought a little more people into the fold about the soda thing, perhaps it wouldn't have been quick to appeal. You
right.
know, if you can build a consensus
right.
and you can get like-minded people to carry the water together, you probably don't have to undo the decision.
No, it occurred to me that that was very much like the, you know, it took a long time for smoking bans to come, mm-hmm. and people thought that it would kill every industry in the world, and it didn't.
Yeah, you know, in New York, it's fashionable to bully people, and I'm not certain that's the best foundation for a new business.
No, I guess it's not, although I could probably pick a few of your colleagues who seem to have done pretty well
yeah,
with
they,
that
they
theory,
probably
right?
make more than I do, too, so.
Well, that's not so bad. Well, so now that you've done these two things, and you know, I want to talk about this kind of transition that you're making. You're not behind the stove, in front of the stove every day, are you?
No, I'm not. I've signed 8 commercial leases in Manhattan, and I've had 6 liquor licenses. And a few years back, I had 4 operational restaurants. And when I did that...
Are you going to say you had a partridge in a pear tree before?
not today.
All right.
But when I did that, I had a pretty strong necessity to have great leaders in the kitchens. And then when I decided to take it apart, I didn't necessarily think people should lose their jobs. Albeit, up until 2 months ago, I have been the chef of the Harrison for
yeah.
the last few years. And let me just say this right off the bat. I've never had a better job than being a cook. And I would much prefer to be insulated and to just be able to work with the food the way I want to work with the food, albeit, you know, a small business owner in America, it might not be the most prudent thing to pick the area that you like the most and focus on that.
Well, you know, in my massive research that I do before I interview a guest, I actually checked their Twitter accounts, and I saw a lament on your Twitter account that said, "Oh, it was so much easier being behind the stove."
Yeah. There's a little bit more instant gratification that goes in with pleasing somebody yeah. over a lovely dish that you prepared than negotiating a good workman's comp rate.
You know what? That's pretty sexy stuff.
Yeah,
you know, on my side of the table, that's pretty sexy
stuff.
It's
a little lost on me.
You know?
I'll do it.
Well, we all have to do what we have to do, right, to make payroll.
That's my job description.
So what do you think? So what really works best? I mean, now, you know, you've seen a couple of structures. You've been successful in both. You know, to the next generation of restaurateur, you're a mentor to the next generation of restaurateur. How do you advise them? I mean, about raising capital. It's harder now.
Yeah,
it's harder.
I mean, my number one bit of advice is don't be afraid to do your own homework and really get to the heart of the matter of your own ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Build the best foundation you can and keep your day job until your night job can afford you.
Ah, well, you know what? I like the way that's expressed. The the world is full of, you know, young men and young women in a hurry. And, the streets littered with former restaurants that are laundromats, right? So you really do need to take your time. You need to mature a little bit. Our mutual friend Andrew Carmelini in a very interesting article I read today, really said he took his time. You know, you said you were 31. I wanted to work in other people's kitchens and see how they did their business before I went out and asked other people to bet on me.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a smart man.
Well, you know, it's a common theme, I think, among successful restaurateurs. From
the tortoise did win the race in the tortoise and hare. It's not the most fashionable position, but again, if I can keep the ball moving forward and I don't have to stop or change direction and or... you have to change what you do to stay current, yeah. But if I can build a consensus and I can get people going along with me, I fancy it's easier than the herky-jerky aspect that the youth is pretty accustomed to these days.
You know, I think at 38 years old, Derek Jeter batted 320, right? So, yeah. You know, it's doable, yeah. Right? It's doable. Tell me about this. You know, you're not exactly a recovering chef, and you're certainly not a retired chef. Before we jump down to another road of business, though, I have this curiosity that just I have to ask. So you did a stint on Top Chef Masters.
Yes.
Why the heck did you do that?
I guess a couple different reasons. I'm not big into the competitions.
Yeah, because, you don't strike me as that guy.
Well, you know, really the way I feel about it is I have to compete for every dollar and for every customer there is. So staying in a business for 15 years is a pretty extensive competition that I put myself in through and involved in every day. Albeit, you know, it's always fun to hang out with your peers.
It's a collegial competition when yes. You're out on the street.
Until you win it.
Yeah,
and then,
right?
Then you get bragging rights.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wasn't opposed to winning it. and I went there with, you know, all the wind I had in my sails. You know, it wasn't in the cards for me that time, but, you know.
So just out of curiosity, did it have an impact on the restaurants?
Well, unfortunately, I was paired off in a team on the first episode, and our team didn't make it past the first episode. So I think I was only maybe on camera for half hour, 25 minutes or so. So
those producers.
It's all fine. I enjoyed my time there. And, you know, people speak fondly about the Red Cat often. I don't always know where it comes from, but I assume some of it is coming from every little avenue that we put out there.
Yeah, cool. So what's missing in the New York scene? I mean, here you are. You've been doing this for quite some time. You're obviously a creative guy. You don't want to sit and rest on your laurels. What's missing? What's next? What's new?
Well, I don't know if I can tell you what I'm thinking is new because I wouldn't mind opening the business to show you what it is. I have two ideas that I think, well, I'm certain that no one in New York is doing the way that I would do them. One of them, I'm certain no one is doing, period. And I think it's pretty sharp fun. And it's about how to serve people. It's the same style of food. You know, it's Jimmy Bradley style of food, but it's a method of service that, and it's not bells and whistles and putting my guys in tuxedos or anything like that. It's just doing it differently. And it's certainly not no backs on the chairs and paper napkins like some other people out there.
Yep.
But it's an in between, and I think it would be pretty well appreciated.
So then, you know, I'm not the kind of guy who wants to beans to be spilled before they should. We just talked about patience and patience being a virtue. Is there an economic component to changing the way service is delivered?
Well, yeah. I mean, I showed you a little bit of this at the Mermaid. My idea for the Mermaid was every bottle of wine was $15 over cost. And in order to be able to afford that, we had to do additional turns. So every entree was under $20. It was riddled in value. So instead of the normal three turns, we needed four to pay for it. Mm-hmm. The only way to get four turns was not to offer dessert. Not to offer dessert and not to be, you know...
Not a lingering place.
Not so much, but also steeped in hospitality, mm-hmm. We would give you free dessert. So at the end of the meal, we would say, here's complimentary dessert. We don't have a dessert menu. So we got it up to five turns. But the beauty of my idea was I buy a bottle of Peter Michael Chardonnay for $60 and sell it for $75. You go anywhere else and they sell it for $180.
Exactly.
So if I can get two bottles at $150 or maybe $160 versus one bottle at $180 and I give you that value, I'm pretty sure we're going to have a good foundation for a relationship.
Right. You said the words. you said relationship, and I really think that that's really what a Jimmy Bradley dining experience.
Yeah, it's
really
not
is.
The classic, again, how we learned it when we moved here. It's not the us against them, and it's not, yeah, the customer's always right, you can do whatever you want to me, and I'll just deal with it. There's a happy medium with every relationship that leaves both people satiated, not left wanting, and willing to come back to the table for more. And that's where I was with it.
So have you had the big desire? You had the big desire to be in Vegas, to be in Dubai. Have you had all that? You just decided, you know, I like what I'm doing? Or
No, interestingly enough, I haven't had that. We were offered a deal in Los Angeles right before the Harrison opened, and we went to sign. And then one day I woke up and I said, I don't want to do that. My business partner said, why? And I said, I don't want one of my business offices to be 3,000 miles away from another one. Yeah. I just don't feel like managing my businesses like that. So for the most part, I'm not so interested in around the world, but I do think the Red Cat is the kind of concept that could go into any city in America.
Yeah,
that was, you know, interested in food and the way we do business, which in turn I think is, you know, lots and lots of different towns and cities in America.
I moved away from the Harrison for a minute, but I want to go back to it because an important, I really want you to talk about, with the Harrison you did something completely new, meaning that you had a new business structure, you had a new investment structure. You told me that you opened it by actually buying a pre-existing restaurant, your key money, which is really the fastest way to get into the business, you know, right, still.
Yeah.
But almost right after you opened, we had this terrible tragedy, you know, in our city, in our country, 9/11. How did you survive that?
I don't know if I have one specific answer for that.
And, you know, I mean the business. Yes, I'm talking about the business.
We signed the lease April 1st, and we were scheduled to open September 17th. And when the 11th happened, it was a disaster, you know, for everybody included. And we were down for 4 weeks of no information. And when we got a little bit of information, I think we just decided that we were here for the neighborhood. That was our core business philosophy. Yep. And I'm pretty sure the neighborhood could use a good watering hole right now and a place to dine. So let's just hurry up and get it open. And if we go out, of business, I can live with those terms because none of this was planned. And again, it's small business in America. And, you know, sometimes you get lucky and hit the number, and sometimes your luck runs out and, you know, your lease runs out or some unforeseen thing happens and you just, you know, have to sell the business or close the business. So I was at peace with bringing it to life, even if it was a very short life, and not for a business play and not for a return, but more or less for just the reason why we decided to do it. I think we got something that would work in that neighborhood and would be appreciated. Let's just get it done and see what happens.
Jimmy, I like your style. Hey, we're running out of time today, but you got to make me one promise.
Anything.
I know. Wow. Well,
I mean, if you're going to say it on the air.
All right. No. You got to make me a promise because I can see just by looking at you have a couple ideas percolating that maybe aren't mature enough to express.
I'm just waiting for the landlords to come around to come reality.
Back. Well, we're gonna take off for today. The business of the business is going to sign off. Jim, before we do, did you bring a business plan that we can slide under any doors here in Brooklyn?
I did not.
All right. Well, next time you come, bring that business plan and we'll do it.
Indeed.
Folks, thanks for listening. Phil Colicchio on the business of the business here on the Heritage Radio Network. Jimmy Bradley, I got some pretty good pizza here at Roberta's.
Looking forward.
Let's check it. All right, guys. Next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.